I was fortunate to participate in the second and third sessions in December 2019 and October 2020 in Washington and New Delhi, respectively. My Indian counterpart was Rajnath Singh, an experienced politician with many years in government who had assumed the defense post in May 2019. Singh was a solemn and reticent minister whom I found to be an able colleague. He was interested in strengthening relations between our two countries and was able to keep his ministry moving forward. This was evident as a border crisis in the Himalayas with China in 2020 heated up. The history of 1962 seemed to be repeating itself. At our first meeting in December 2019, we were able to get a fair number of things accomplished. Singh and I had good discussions at the Pentagon, making substantial progress in our military relationship and expanding cooperation between our armed services. We launched a new annual exercise in November called Tiger Triumph that enhanced tri-service coordination and allowed us to exchange a good deal of knowledge and expertise. We concluded what was called the Industrial Security Annex, which facilitates collaboration between our defense industries by supporting the secure transfer of key information and technology. And we also completed three agreements under the Defense Technology and Trade Initiative that we developed to enhance our ability to co-produce and co-develop critical technologies. In his public remarks, Singh mentioned that these accomplishments, as well as the establishment of communications links between the Indian military and Indo-Pacific Command, the assignment of a liaison officer at our naval headquarters in Bahrain, and the conduct of a defense policy group meeting after a four-year hiatus, were positive steps forward. We had also made progress on maritime domain awareness, an issue of particular importance to New Delhi given the presence of Chinese ships, especially submarines, in Indian territorial waters. Singh also pressed hard that the industrial relationship move beyond New Delhi, simply buying arms from the United States. They wanted much deeper cooperation, as many nations do, such as technology sharing and co-production. Their aim was to build up their own defense industry capabilities. This was neither new nor unreasonable, though there are inherent challenges. I had heard the same message over the previous 15 or more years, whether it was during my tenure on Capitol Hill, when I took a business delegation from the Aerospace Industries Association to India in the mid-2000s, or during my industry time at Raytheon. While this was an issue both sides needed to keep working on together, I was never confident that we could get to the point that India wanted and expected. The U.S. government will always work to protect certain high-end technologies, and American companies will want to do the same out of their own business interests, even from our closest of allies. We made good progress at the broader meeting with our foreign ministry counterparts, too. New agreements on space exploration, a novel exchange program for legislators, and an update on a bilateral trade deal were topics discussed. Pompeo celebrated the inaugural meeting of the Quad in September 2019, and I followed up with a push for the Quad's militaries to begin exercising together, something the Indians resisted. Our private deliberations touched on a number of international topics: Afghanistan, Iran, and of course China, to name a few. During Singh's visit, we were able to host a nice dinner for the minister and his delegation at the Library of Congress, which seemed an unlikely place to hold such an event. My team did a great job setting this up, though. The dinner itself was wonderful, but the majesty of the library and its inner sanctums was a special surprise to see and share with our Indian friends. At the end of the evening, we were able to take them to a section of the library that contained several ancient and historical Indian works written in Hindi. Singh and his team stopped at different sections of this room to read the books. He and his entourage were impressed by the works and the thoughtfulness of my event organizers. So was I. When I broke with the president in early June 2020 over the Insurrection Act, I felt sure it would be difficult for me to stay in office through the election. And with the India trip right up against it in late October, the 2+2 meeting was an engagement of such importance that I knew I would regret missing if I was fired early. But as it turned out, I was able to attend. In the spring, a series of skirmishes developed between Indian and Chinese troops along their shared border in the Himalayas, in the historically disputed areas in Ladakh near the Tibet Autonomous Region. The renewed friction began in late May 2020 when the Chinese objected to the building of a road by India in the Galwan River Valley. The hand-to-hand fighting that took place in mid-June resulted in the deaths of 20 Indian soldiers and at least one Chinese officer, and the taking of several prisoners from both sides, in what marked the most serious conflict between the two countries in many years. This latest incident seemed to be a transparent move by the PRC to advance its territorial claims during a global pandemic. The Himalayas were another area where Beijing was making excessive and/or illegal claims on territory and waters around its periphery, just as it was doing in the South China Sea. In other parts of the world, President Xi was using debt diplomacy, economic incentives, security cooperation, political strong-arming, and corrupt business practices to gain footholds in key strategic locations, ranging from Africa and Southeast Asia to the Pacific Island countries and South America. The Indians were standing up to the CCP, and we wanted to help. I reached out early to Singh to offer U.S. assistance. There was some reluctance from New Delhi at first, but we were able to begin with simple information sharing about PLA activities in the mountainous region contested by the Chinese. Eventually, over a series of calls and interactions between our departments, we provided their troops with cold weather gear so they could better operate in the harsh environment of the Himalayas, and began discussing the acceleration of certain arms purchases. As September rolled into October and our 2+2 meeting approached, the Indians' border standoff with the Chinese remained tense, despite a series of diplomatic initiatives. On the ground, neither side was budging. This made New Delhi anxious for a positive outcome during our visit. The success of the meetings was preordained, though, thanks to the hard work of our respective teams in the months leading up to our session. The Indians were gracious hosts during our stay, and the dialogue, which marked the 15th anniversary of the first U.S.-India Defense Framework Initiative, went extremely well. Mike Pompeo and I also had the chance to participate in ceremonial events in Delhi and meet with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi to further discuss the issues covered in our counterpart sessions. All in all, it was a great visit. A major accomplishment of this third 2+2 dialogue was the signing of the Basic Exchange and Cooperation Agreement for Geospatial Information and Services Cooperation, BECA, which expanded the sharing of this intelligence between our armed forces. The BECA was the last of four key agreements between Washington and New Delhi considered to be crucial to the expansion of strategic ties between our countries. It was particularly relevant and timely given the situation in the Himalayas opposite the Chinese, while also boosting U.S.-Indian military cooperation more broadly. Our meetings also confirmed or finalized several other initiatives, such as the establishment of new cyber and space dialogues, again given the common threat of China, and the advancement of maritime security with like-minded nations such as Japan and Australia. In the open-air press conference closing out our 2 days of talks, I made clear that the U.S.-India partnership remained more important than ever as we worked to ensure security, stability, and prosperity in a world under siege by a global pandemic, and as we stood shoulder to shoulder in light of increased aggression and destabilizing activities by China. We had accomplished a great deal and moved the ball considerably forward in the time Pompeo and I had to work with our counterparts. Beijing's aggressiveness helped accelerate things too. The key going forward was to broaden, institutionalize, and regularize this cooperation. The combined exercise in the Indian Ocean between our two navies in July 2020, which featured the USS Nimitz Carrier Strike Group, was important. But even more imperative was India's decision, at our urging, to include Australia in the upcoming Malabar naval exercise among Indian, American, and Japanese forces. Including all members of the Quad in this military exercise, something Beijing opposed and New Delhi had long been reluctant to do, was a major step forward to building the partnerships needed to maintain a free and open Indo-Pacific in the years ahead. In the grand scheme, when one looks at the arc of history since India gained its independence in 1947, it appears that U.S.-India relations are finally on the right path and making steady progress. There is much that naturally binds our two countries. And these days, the rise of China, which had been foreseen by some decades earlier, is occurring in an ominous way for both countries. If China is the greatest strategic challenge the United States will face in the 21st century, and I believe it is, then India is the most important strategic partnership we need to develop to deal with it. In late August, only 2 months before the 2+2 dialogue in India, I visited Hawaii, Guam, and Palau. In Honolulu, I spoke at the Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies about the PLA's growing capabilities, Beijing's efforts to bully other countries and undermine the rules-based international order, and what the United States was doing in response. My visit to Guam included a tour of our military facilities on the island, a meeting with the governor, and an extended session with the Japanese defense minister to discuss China. And in Palau, I met with the president of the small but strategic island nation to discuss ways to improve our partnership and keep Beijing out. I also made important phone calls to the leaders of Sri Lanka and Bangladesh, the governor of the Northern Marianas, and my counterpart in Papua New Guinea. These stops and calls built on my earlier travels when I visited New Zealand and Mongolia, the first time a Secretary of Defense had visited both since 2012 and 2014, respectively, and other locations such as Vietnam and the Philippines. A major part of this visit was to get an update from Admiral Phil Davidson, the Indo-PACOM commander, on the next iteration of his war planning for conflict with China. The plan continued to improve as we went back and forth on it over several months. Additionally, I wanted to better understand his vision of the theater for the future. Specifically, what would the Indo-Pacific need to look like in 2035? And what should the military footprint and capabilities of the U.S. Armed Forces and our partners be if we wanted to ensure our success against a modernized PLA by the mid-2030s? Our footprint in Asia was heavy in the northeast and too light in the southeast. Much of this was legacy positioning from the end of World War II, coupled with the challenges we continued to face with North Korea. The command recognized this too, but rather than working with the resources they had, they wanted more to spread throughout the region. To improve our presence around the mainland of China, we could look at shifting more assets from another geographic command, but there really wasn't much more available without major impacts in other areas. I pressed them to look at other options within their own control, such as rotational deployments out of Japan or off the Korean Peninsula to other parts of the Indo-Pacific. I even pushed them to consider permanent intra-theater adjustments, but either the initiative, innovation, or will to do so wasn't there. Change is hard at the DoD, as it is in many organizations. For too many, change is a threat to them, their budget, or their organization. For others, it is a fear of the unknown or of failing. Some are simply content to stay in their comfort zone. At the Pentagon, the weapon of choice for getting more resources is the phrase mission requirement. But when it comes to opposing change, the magic words are increased risk. Nobody wants to be blamed for a decision that risks the mission or the force. Many recall Secretary of Defense Les Aspin being forced to resign after he refused to provide tanks, armored vehicles, and other equipment requested by the U.S. commander in Somalia not long before the Battle of Mogadishu in 1993. This was the Black Hawk Down fight that saw 18 U.S. soldiers killed and dozens more wounded. This story still resonates at the Pentagon. But the fact is, in a resource-constrained world where threats and challenges abound, missions must be prioritized, risk must be managed, and hard decisions have to be made. From 2019 through 2020, for example, I faced the problem of year-round staging of bombers out of Anderson Air Force Base in Guam. Since 2004, what started out as a temporary deployment of B-1 and B-52 bombers to the U.S. territory morphed into what became known as Continuous Bomber Presence, CBP. The argument to keep bombers in Guam was that it was a mission requirement that deterred bad behavior from North Korea by having a ready capability closer to the Korean Peninsula. The bombers also ostensibly reassured our allies that we would fight alongside them in conflict and allowed more training with them too. Removing the aircraft from the theater would create increased risk. The argument for ending CBP was that it was having a harmful impact on the readiness of our bomber fleets, as well as on the airmen who fly and support the planes. Additionally, it limited our flexibility to respond to other parts of the globe by stationing the aircraft in the middle of the Pacific Ocean assigned to a single command. All of this combined created its own level of risk. I was keen to the readiness argument, but equally important, we needed to fully effectuate the national defense strategy. One of my top 10 objectives included operationalizing the dynamic force employment, DFE, concept. DFE meant the Pentagon would prioritize maintaining the capacity for major combat operations by employing these forces in short sprints and quick, no-notice deployments that make us less operationally predictable and more strategically flexible without wearing out the force. It was also a good way not only to reassure more of our allies and partners, but to keep our adversaries off balance as well. I also wanted to use DFE to evaluate the readiness of our immediate response forces, IRF, those Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps units that had to be ready to deploy in 10 days or less. To make this real, I put over $500 million in the budget for these so-called no-notice operations. I'm not sure the Defense Department had ever done anything like this at the enterprise level, but I wanted to emphasize readiness from the top down. General Milley and I worked a good deal on this initiative. We wanted to take the operating model used in the Army, whereby ready units like the 82nd Airborne Division, which were always on alert, were actually called out on a routine basis. Other services were doing this too. This would evaluate their readiness to see if they could get all their troops and equipment assembled, ready, and prepared to deploy on time. It was this readiness standard that gave us confidence in deploying the 82nd to the Middle East in January 2020. Finally, I wanted to employ the IRF not only for readiness tests, but also for pre-planned training events and exercises around the world. In other words, if AFRICOM was planning a multilateral exercise in Morocco and wanted a company of Marines to take part, we could deploy them on a no-notice mission from the IRF. This would result in not only a good readiness test for the DoD, but also a good training event for the units and the command. We had debated what to do with CBP for many months, with neither side yielding to the other's arguments. Then I visited Minot Air Force Base, home of the 5th Bomb Wing, which is the B-52H unit assigned to the base. During my tour, I had the chance to walk around, climb up in, and sit in the cockpit of this famous workhorse. It was also a good chance to talk with the pilots, free from a crowd. A place to get the facts. We talked about CBP, the Guam mission, and their own readiness. And what they shared with me was the impacts the constant rotations were having on full mission training, crew readiness, maintenance, and families. I went straight from the hangar to a town hall to speak to the officers, airmen, Air Force civilians, and family members assigned to the base. I enjoyed doing these events. It was a great opportunity to share with them the priorities I had for the department, and in this case, the Air Force in particular, and then have the chance to answer their questions and hear what was on their minds. Sure enough, during the Q&A session, a spouse spoke up and told the story of her husband, whom the Air Force deployed for several months to Guam on the CBP mission. She recounted how the service extended his tour indefinitely, and about the challenges she faced as a single mom while her spouse was gone. Her story was touching and personal. I faintly recall her holding a young child in one arm with another sitting next to her as she shared this experience with the entire audience. My sense was that we were going to lose this airman and his family when reenlistment time came. As she spoke, I could see the heads of other spouses nodding in agreement. It was an emotional story, and one I understood well from my service and Leah's times as a single mom in Italy when my infantry battalion deployed for weeks at a time. Military life was hard, and I always thought it was most difficult for the families left behind. We often said in the Army that you recruit the soldier, but retain the family. And this spouse's tale brought that adage to life. It also reflected what I was hearing from senior Air Force officers in the Pentagon. I left Minot determined to resolve the CBP issue once and for all. I returned to Washington, D.C. days later and decided to end the CBP in Guam. Indo-Pacific Command wasn't happy. There would be significant risk, they said, but I had to balance a broader range of interests. Despite all the doom and gloom, other than a few foreboding stories in the military press, life went on without the bomber mission, and with our DFE operations picking up the bomber role as planned. Tellingly, I never received a phone call from any of my counterparts in Asia expressing concern about ending the CBP mission, nor did it come up in any of our meetings. That said a lot. Within a few short months, we had bombers flying many more missions to Europe, the Middle East, and elsewhere, while still sustaining their operations in the Pacific. Picking up more of these missions was a promise made and kept by the Air Force, and I was pleased to see them go so well. In fact, in August 2020, U.S. bombers flew in formation across all 30 NATO countries in a single day as a show of support to our allies. The operation was called Allied Sky, and it featured the new Bomber Task Forces, the Air Force's name for using bombers to implement DFE, in a demonstration of our strategic reach, operational flexibility, support for allies and partners, and overall warfighting capability. But what really hit me was the reaction of the bomber crews. Months later, I was visiting an Air Force installation and noticed that a pilot with whom I was speaking had a tab on his left shoulder sleeve. All the tab had written on it was a date, April 17th, 2020, I believe, and so I asked him what it represented. He looked me in the eye and said, "Sir, that's when CBP finally ended for us. Thank you." In making decisions like these, you have to balance not only the competing demands between different combatant commands, but also the tension between the needs of today, as represented by those combatant commands, with the needs of the future, as often represented by the services. I constantly wished more of the senior military officers would take an enterprise perspective, putting themselves in my shoes. Some did this better than others, but at the end of the day, it was my job to balance these things and to make the final call. Chapter 21. Unrest in the Northwest.
"I want to go in. We need to show them force," the president exclaimed. I couldn't believe it was August 2020 and we were still discussing civil unrest, except now it was Portland, Oregon, not Washington, D.C. Here we were again, back in the Oval Office, talking about sending the National Guard, who the president would need to federalize, into a city against the governor's will. It felt like Groundhog Day. The president's eagerness to deploy military forces into U.S. cities didn't end in June. The protests in several cities, but especially Portland, seemed to drive him crazy over the summer and into the early fall. Time and again, we would end up in meetings at the White House to discuss the ongoing unrest. Each time, we would need to push back on his proposals to send in the Guard. Bill Barr remained a good ally on this front, as did Acting Secretary of Homeland Security Chad Wolf. We all seemed to be dealing with something that gnawed at the president viscerally. Much like in June, he seemed to take the Portland protests as personal affronts not only to his authority, but to his strength and reputation. Trump would often repeat how the protests make us look weak and a laughingstock, which inevitably were followed by statements that we need to do something about this. For me, these were serious but time-consuming distractions to the far more important work of dealing with COVID and engaging my foreign counterparts, not to mention keeping a watchful eye on China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea. My combatant command reviews were also continuing, especially with Central Command, its long-term footprint, and the deployment of American air defense assets in the region. We were making good, steady progress. We were also working our way through another iteration of Indo-Pacific Command's updated China War Plan. All of this, coupled with Operation Warp Speed updates, finalizing our parts of the Abraham Accords, and video teleconferences with the shipbuilding industry to understand their capacity and needs, was the vital work of the Pentagon. Other important initiatives were also underway. For example, on Monday, August 10th, the White House and the DoD announced a bold plan to accelerate the development of 5G across the nation.
We had quietly begun working this plan months earlier with the aim of freeing up 100 megahertz of contiguous mid-band spectrum allocated to the military to share with industry. This idea had been out there for years, but the leadership among the Departments of Commerce and Defense, the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, and the White House couldn't agree on a way forward that addressed everyone's concerns, responsibilities, and objectives. At the Pentagon, a few of us recognized the importance of 5G to the country for many reasons beyond our nation's security, such as our continued economic growth, technological leadership, and ability to stay ahead of China. Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General John Hyten, and Dana Deasy, the DoD's Chief Information Officer, were real leaders on this issue. The faster speeds and reduced latency of 5G would be crucial to a range of industries and cutting-edge innovations, such as self-driving cars, that will rely on 5G, AI, and related systems. I was proud that the team, led by Deasy, took a 1 to 2 year process and compressed it down to 4 months, while protecting the DoD's core equities. It was an extraordinary feat, and while it would come at some cost to the DoD in terms of altering our operational practices, changing training regimes, and making new equipment investments, it was the right thing to do. Notwithstanding this accomplishment, Mark Meadows would push hard throughout the fall of 2020 for the Pentagon to essentially award a no-bid contract for a bigger, separate chunk of the DoD's mid-band spectrum. It was to be written in a way that seemed to favor a single tech company, one that had close ties to power brokers within the GOP. The White House Chief of Staff wanted this completed by the election and made clear on more than one occasion that Trump was fully behind it. Neither the Pentagon nor other agency stakeholders supported this unprecedented multi-billion-dollar spectrum grab. For defense, we needed time to assess the impact of this idea on our training, exercises, testing, and the operational ways that we protect the homeland on a routine basis, for example. Moreover, the costs associated with relinquishing the spectrum, developing new capabilities and workarounds, and the risks that all this created were enormous. We also needed time to assess a claim by the company that it had developed a unique solution called dynamic sharing, which would supposedly allow multiple companies to operate and coexist in the same spectrum space. Extensive testing and evaluation were needed to validate these functional claims. Importantly, we made clear on more than one occasion that defense did not have the authority to award the spectrum. Rather, spectrum management was the purview of the Federal Communications Commission or the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, depending on whether it is a non-governmental or governmental application, respectively. Meadows pressed just the same. Fortunately, the deliberate churn of our internal processes and continued messaging back to the White House with our interagency counterparts blunted this dubious idea. That same day the official White House Spectrum Initiative was announced, August 10th, the Washington Post ran a story with the headline, "Unrest in Chicago and Portland shows America's summer of protest is far from over." Over the preceding weekend, protesters had looted stores in downtown Chicago and set the police union headquarters in Portland ablaze. These things infuriated Trump. At this point in the campaign, law and order was his theme, and these actions struck at the heart of this mantra. In the previous days, as the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, withdrew agents from Portland to de-escalate the situation, things had calmed down some. But the weekend was rough, and on that Monday, Trump tweeted, "Portland, which is out of control, should finally, after almost 3 months, bring in the National Guard. The mayor and governor are putting people's lives at risk. They will be held responsible. The Guard is ready to act immediately." Trump called for an 8 a.m. meeting the next day in the Oval Office to discuss what to do. I had just flown to South Carolina for a few days off at the beach with Leah. We had not taken vacation in over a year and were not off to a good start that Monday. Tuesday was already looking bad. I should have stayed in D.C., I thought, as I prepped for the meeting. I called in to the Oval Office session. Bill Barr, Chad Wolf, Mark Milley, and Ken Cuccinelli, who was serving as the senior official performing the duties of the Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security, were also present. Trump was still irritated and started off aggressively, as he typically did. He wasn't one to put an issue on the table and then listen for feedback, or at least give others the illusion of hearing them out first.
He went straight to the matter. I want to go in. We need to show them force. Barr quickly jumped in, as he should have. This was a law enforcement matter, not a military one. The Attorney General was the point person, followed by Wolf. They needed to lead the discussion. In my view, if I was talking, that wasn't a good thing. Being on the other end of a phone line helped me here, but Millie was trapped in the room. Barr led with, "If you do this, more cities will go south," meaning that the unrest and violence would spread. Bill and I had discussed this a few times previously and believed it would be the consequence of sending in the military. He added that law enforcement didn't have the resources to handle this if the violence spread. Trump responded, "The guard got control of Minneapolis in an hour. We need to show force. I want to go into Chicago with force." Barr kept pushing back, now arguing from a political angle that the violence in these cities was actually working against the Democrats. The back and forth continued, with Barr proposing that Justice and DHS put together a strategy to deal with the violence in a more comprehensive way, and that they would come back to the president in 2 to 3 weeks to brief him. This was good. Barr was buying time. The DOD wasn't mentioned, and the president hadn't directed any questions at Milley or me yet. But Trump wasn't persuaded. The president was unrelenting, saying, "We look weak and stupid and pathetic. It looks badly on us." He added, "I'm running for re-election and we have cities burning down. We have to go and do something. We need to be on the offensive. You need to shoot that person that throws a rock at you." Oh my God. Were we back to talking about shooting people again? I couldn't believe it. I set down my pen and put my hands over my face as I shook my head, a convenient luxury that a distant phone connection provides. I thought, hoped, that such a notion had left him. Yet here we were again. The debate wasn't moving along enough, so I felt it was time to jump in and support Barr. Bill and I didn't have the chance to speak before the meeting, but he was spot on. This was indeed a law enforcement action. There was no need whatsoever for the military, including the National Guard. If a state needed the Guard, then the governors had all the authority they required to call them up and put them to work. Plus, the states weren't Washington, D.C. Any mobilization of Guard units to deploy to another state needed the consent of both governors, unless the Insurrection Act was invoked, which was something we definitely didn't need or want. In short, Barr's plan needed to succeed. After all, DOJ's success would mean the DOD's success. Taking a little time to look at the problem more comprehensively, and then coming back with a strategy for the president's review was the way to tackle tough, complex issues. It also allowed time for things to settle down, and for law enforcement to work the issues behind the scenes. It wasn't the way of this White House, though. Fire, aim, ready was the typical approach, and too many folks around Trump enabled that style of decision-making. So with the president still undecided, and having learned that more voices opposing him always helped, I decided to weigh in. "Mr. President, I support Bill's plan. This is a law enforcement action, and I recommend we let him come back in a few weeks to present it." I told him that these cities are all different, and in Minneapolis, we had a supportive governor who knew the Guard and who had all the authority he needed to act. But these cities all have different histories and cultures and leadership, things we can't change, I said. I followed up with words to the effect of, "And if you go in heavy with force, then it will spread across the country, and we'll be dealing with this for the next few months. You don't want to own that." Millie had been uncharacteristically quiet throughout the meeting, but helpfully jumped in behind me with facts and stats that downplayed the extent of the unrest and the violence. Trump watched TV all day long, and that gave him a distorted view, a soda straw perspective, we'd say, about what was happening. There really weren't that many people causing violence. It just looked that way through the camera lens of Fox News. The bottom line was that the country wasn't burning, a phrase mentioned by Trump and often used by Stephen Miller to incite him, and that we were basically talking about three cities, Chicago, Portland, and Seattle. And in each of these, the violent actors were a small minority of those on the streets. The facts never seemed to stop Miller from egging on the president's worst instincts, however, using hyperbole like, "The cities are burning down," and "The governor," or "The mayor has lost control of the situation."
Miller's implication was that a tough federal response was not just recommended, but necessary if we were going to save our country from Antifa, as he pressed for invocation of the Insurrection Act. Millie and I tended to ignore Miller, but he somehow seemed to press Bill Barr's buttons in ways no one else could. Not surprisingly, Bill erupted on him again, yelling back, "You don't know what the hell you're talking about," and then making a reference to the 1993 siege of a religious sect in Waco, Texas, by law enforcement and the military. 20 law enforcement agents were either killed or wounded in the incident, as well as over 70 others. Nobody wanted a repeat of anything close to Waco, especially the Attorney General. The conversation went back and forth a little longer, with both Wolf and Cuccinelli finally speaking up as well in support of Barr's proposal. DHS had been bearing the brunt of the work in Portland, with agents defending the federal buildings the violent agitators seemed to be going after. I had spoken to Chad Wolf a couple of weeks earlier, and I knew that his folks were worn down. He, too, was looking for ways to de-escalate. In the face of this unified front, Trump finally yielded. He wasn't happy about it. I pictured him sitting behind his desk with his arms folded across his chest, shaking his head slowly with a frustrated look on his face. He grudgingly, hesitatingly said, "Okay, come back with a plan then, in 2 to 3 weeks. But it needs to be an offensive plan, and should include the National Guard." He seemed to feel the need to throw in that last part about the Guard. Not only did it reflect his predilection, and indeed his intention, but it was a way to yield the discussion without completely conceding. 9 days later, on August 20th, I was in Colorado to host the changes of command for Northern Command and Space Command. These ceremonies are important events used to inform everyone of the seamless transfer of command from one leader to another, to honor the outgoing officer, and to welcome the new one. It's also a chance to speak about the important roles that NORTHCOM and now SPACECOM play in our nation's defense. I was especially proud of our establishment of Space Command in August 2019, and its critical role as the warfighting command, as compared to the Space Force with its manning, training, and equipping duties, in protecting U.S. defense and commercial assets in the heavens by being ready to conduct offensive and defensive space operations. This ultimate high ground is vital not only to our security, but also to the global economy, science, and our way of life. With Russia and China militarizing space, and seeing it as a domain where they could cripple U.S. capabilities in the first moves of a future conflict, Space Command would be a game-changer in preventing that outcome. The DoD published a defense space strategy in June 2020 that addressed these matters. As for Northern Command, they had responsibility for leading the DoD's support to civilian authorities, which meant deploying troops to help during hurricanes, wildfires, floods, and any other type of natural disaster that hits the country. They were also responsible for COVID support across the country, such as helping cities and states set up hospitals, move supplies, and administer tests. NORTHCOM had a very busy, but also very successful year, and deserved some extra special recognition and attention. As I reviewed my remarks a few minutes before going on stage at 10 a.m., my aide interrupted to say that Chief of Staff Meadows wanted to speak with me about Portland. Portland? I had not heard of anything happening the evening before. Apparently, he was calling to see if the National Guard was ready. What did that mean? Ready for what exactly? I didn't recall Meadows being on the phone call with Trump the week prior, so maybe he was playing catch-up. More likely, however, was that he was reacting to something the president said. My team told Meadows I was about to go on stage, so he instead tried to call General Dan Hokanson, the new chief of the National Guard Bureau, I was informed later. What was so urgent? I asked at that point. DHS told us nothing was happening anywhere in the country, including Portland, that they couldn't handle. Moreover, if something did, then they would go to justice first. Chad Wolf and his team were being good partners, and I appreciated that. They understood our view on the tiering of forces, as we called it, with defense being last in the queue. But why was Meadows pushing, and why was he reaching into the DoD? He had told me he was a chain of command guy who would work through me, but this was another example where he proved not to be what he said he was. I kept this in mind as we approached November 3rd. I was fortunate to now have General Dan Hokanson at the helm of the National Guard. Dan and I had known each other since we were classmates at West Point. Tall and lean with a distance runner's frame, which he did as a top athlete for the academy, he became an aviator after we graduated. Like me, he left active duty after several years, but eventually joined the Army National Guard in Oregon. His experiences after that would serve him especially well in his new role. He served as the Adjutant General of the Oregon Guard, made deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, and was the Deputy Commander of NORTHCOM. Dan was exceptionally well qualified to be Chief of the National Guard Bureau. He was also smart and a team player who was easy to work with, and importantly, I knew that I could count on him to do the right thing. By the time the ceremony was over and I was available to talk, the issue had faded. Meadows no longer needed to speak with me. What happened? Maybe he spoke to Barr, who told him of our meeting on the 11th and the agreement that he would be bringing the president a new strategy in another week or so. Or maybe it was Wolf. Chad had the right approach as well. I never found out. I ended up having to shut down a more urgent matter regarding Iran that the NSC was pushing at the same time. I'll address this matter later. Nevertheless, the combination of the two issues simultaneously led me to conclude that the president was acting out, and in ways that could produce dire consequences if unchecked. The DOD was once again in the center of the storm, and having to apply the brakes. On Tuesday, August 25th, I flew to Hawaii to participate in a number of long-scheduled events, commemorating the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II, an Indo-Pacific Chiefs of Defense virtual gathering, and my various meetings in Palau and Guam, as already discussed. That morning in Hawaii, I spoke with Bill Barr again by phone. He told me the president was pushing him on the Insurrection Act because he wanted to send the Guard into Portland. So much for Trump waiting for a strategy based on a law enforcement lead, but that he had refused. Neither Barr nor his lawyers believed that the situation warranted invoking the Insurrection Act. Nor did we. However, he was concerned about events getting out of control in cities like Kenosha, Wisconsin, where violence had flared the previous couple of nights after an African-American man, Jacob Blake, was shot in the back by police as he opened the door to his car with his three young sons inside. Barr didn't want law enforcement caught short if things spiraled out of control, so he asked if I could put 1,000 to 2,000 guardsmen on alert around the country for the next 60 days or so. I understood his reasoning, and it made some sense, but doing so presented some challenges. First of all, I told him, I don't like the optics of National Guard units on standby around the country prepared to intervene in another state. I added, it looks like we're enabling the president's worst instincts. In addition, it risked making the DOD look political in the wake of June 1st. Given all that transpired, I liked the fact that it would probably take 24 hours to get a guard unit mobilized, organized, trained, equipped, and deployed. That bought time for elected leaders to calm things down, and for me to argue for more law enforcement first. I didn't say this to Bill, however. Barr saw it differently, I supposed, as a way to fend off another call to bring in the active duty forces. I couldn't argue with that rationale either, but I was still reluctant. We talked through the issue a little further. The anxiety in Bill's voice was increasing, which led me to believe that Trump was pressing him harder than he was letting on, which in turn maybe meant we were closer to invocation of the Insurrection Act than Barr was revealing. Bill was always on my side on this matter, so I relented and told him, I'll have General Milley get with the Guard and start working up some options. I'll get back to you after that, Bill. Milley and Hokanson called me back later in the day. A couple of thousand guardsmen was more than they felt necessary, and more than they could sustain, which confirmed my instinct when Barr first raised it. They were, however, proposing to put one Alabama National Guard military police company, which normally numbered around 150 soldiers, on duty for 2 weeks, and one Guard MP company from Arizona to do the same. The adjutant generals from both states supported this. They just needed to get their governors okay once I approved it. This wasn't the 2-month period Barr was looking for, but it would get us through the GOP convention happening that week, a march planned for D.C. on August 28th and Labor Day weekend. During that time, Millie and Hokanson would work on more sustainable options. I approved the plan and then called Barr to update him. He was good with it as well. On September 4th, a group of us met with Meadows at the White House to brief him on the long-term plan to have Guard MPs available around the country. Generals Hokanson and Milley joined me, with Barr and Wolf on the phone and Stephen Miller there in person. Hokanson talked everyone through the details, which basically called for 4 MP companies, 2 in Arizona and 2 in Alabama, to be on alert over the next 60 to 90 days. This would get us through the election plus a little longer. Units within these companies would be at a tiered readiness level, with a platoon ready to deploy within 2 hours of being alerted, for example. This allowed us to manage the force in a way that wouldn't burn them out and shouldn't affect their civilian employers too much. Meadows liked the plan, as did Barr and the others. General Milley and I were careful to point out a few times that, even with this approach, when transportation timelines and all were factored in, it would still take 10 or more hours after being alerted to get the Guard-ready platoon on the streets somewhere. And that wasn't even factoring in getting permission from each state's governor, coordination on the ground with local Guard units, and so on, we added. That's why, I said, it's important to have law enforcement, local, county, state, and federal, more ready and available if not already on the scene, I stated. We wanted to avoid militarizing the issue. With that, the group broke up with plans to brief the president at 2:30 p.m. As the meeting with Trump began in the Oval Office that afternoon, everyone was in the room except Barr and Wolf, who for some reason I don't believe joined us by phone either. I kicked things off saying, "Mr. President, I want to run you through a plan we developed to have a force of National Guard MPs ready to deploy on short notice around the country, if governors need them." I told Trump that we basically had 4 MP companies with 2 each in Alabama and Arizona at tiered readiness levels, on alert through at least November 15th. The president leaned forward on the Resolute desk, arms folded across it, nodded in seeming agreement as I spoke. I turned to General Milley to explain how the tiered readiness would work, the timelines for alert, deployment and arrival, and other key factors, just as we set forth in the earlier meeting in Meadows' office. General Hokanson largely sat silently, adding in details at times when Milley turned to him. The conversation meandered a bit, as it normally did, but the president conveyed his eagerness to send the Guard into Portland. "We're going to need to send them in," he said. "It's out of control up there in Portland." He repeated his monologue that the unrest makes him look weak and the country look bad. "We need to get tough," he said a few times. We listened and then responded. I was sitting directly in front of the president with Milley to my left, much like we normally did. We were used to being in the Oval Office and hearing the president talk, but Hokanson was a newcomer to the stage. He was farther off to my left, sitting uncomfortably in his chair, keeping a stone-faced demeanor. When Trump talked about the situation in Portland and using the Guard there, I was tempted to push back and cite the fact that Hokanson served as the adjutant general in charge of all Guard troops in Oregon from 2013 to 2015. But I didn't want to drag him unnecessarily into the fray simply to reinforce points I kept trying to land. Milley kept trying to make the case that there really aren't that many protesters, Mr. President, and that the media is making the situation look worse than it is. I picked up the ball and said, "Mr. President, if the military goes in, it will get dramatically worse there and across the country." I added, "Let the mayors of these cities and their governors deal with this. They understand the issue best, and they have the resources to handle it." Trump acknowledged these things, but came back to the necessity to show force and not look weak. Stephen Miller spoke up from the back of the room, a voice of doom describing a carnage that was spreading across America, with cities on fire and Antifa in control. He made it all sound like an apocalypse. In the earlier meeting with Meadows, he had said the United States risked turning into a dystopia, which provoked a verbal backlash from Barr. In Miller's mind, the barbarians were at the gate, and we should unleash the military. If there were only a few violent protesters, he said in response to a statistic from Milley, then the military should be able to quickly put them down.
Milley fumed at this retort, but I don't recall the chairman shouting back at him as others reported, though I do remember Milley lamenting to me privately after the meeting that he should have told him, Miller, to shut the fuck up. The general always took the high road, however, and ignored such stupidity with a simple look of disgust. Regardless, the fact is that Miller didn't seem to get it. He didn't seem to understand that for every person you unnecessarily used a heavy hand against, two, three, or four more would rise up in their place. In my view, everything was black and white to him, and he couldn't see beyond the next move. Like Trump, the answer to most problems for him seemed to be overwhelming force and its blunt employment. All this did was rile the president back up. I agreed that we shouldn't tolerate violence. All it did was hurt people, damage property, and impede the peaceful protesters. But you had to separate the large majority of peaceful protesters exercising their First Amendment rights from the small minority of people breaking the law. Trump, Miller, and others couldn't seem to make that distinction. Rather than using an overwhelming law enforcement presence to protect the former and arrest the latter, Miller seemed to want to use the military to go after them all. Trump picked up the phone and asked an assistant to connect me immediately with the governor of Oregon, Kate Brown. Once on the line, the president was respectful but doing his best to make the case for her to get tough. He was practically pleading with her, "Kate, Kate, you need to get tough with them. You need to arrest them if we're going to end the violence." He added, "I'm ready with the National Guard." She too was respectful and thanked him for his offer to send in the guard, but said she wasn't in the same spot as him and didn't see the situation the same way. The call was surprisingly professional. She fended off his arguments and pleas deftly, and ended it after a few minutes. Both sensing and wanting the meeting to end, I leaned forward in my chair, preparing to stand and leave. Assuming his approval, I said, "Thanks for your time, Mr. President. We'll start moving forward on this plan." And with that, the meeting ended. I had no confidence that this was the end of the discussion, however, but I wanted to get out of the room before Stephen Miller suggested another kooky idea or started spinning the president back up. I had been on the end of this yo-yo too many times, doing my best to keep the military off America's streets. It seemed only a matter of time, especially with White House staff like Miller egging him on. And then fate intervened. The 100 days or so of protests in Portland that began in late May petered out a few days after the September 4th White House meeting, as wind gusts ripping through Oregon and Washington State brought a heavy blanket of smoke from the wildfires burning farther south. The dense smoke that descended on Portland made it hard to breathe and see, so the protesters stayed inside. This lasted only a couple of weeks, but it was enough to break the fever and give law enforcement the opportunity to rest and refit. While all of this was going on, my pace within the Pentagon didn't slacken. I had to keep moving forward on the inside offense part of my game plan. Defense strategy implementation meetings, with a focus on Europe and Africa, occurred, along with budget discussions focused on increasing investment in hypersonics and AI, and improving training and exercises across the joint force. We also had a series of discussions to finalize our proposal for a future naval force, which was enriched by a mid-month visit with the Navy in San Diego to spend a day on an aircraft carrier and then see a few of the unmanned vehicles the Sea Service was developing. It was all great stuff. As September rolled into October, we started becoming less concerned about Trump deploying the military to deal with protesters and more anxious that he might be tempted to do something on November 3rd or the days that followed if things went badly with the election. There was nothing concrete we could point to, but I had been at this now for months, and I knew Trump's instincts and the nature of some of the loyalists in his immediate orbit. None of us at Defense saw a role for the military in the election, other than what we did on the cyber defense front or what the Guard historically did to logistically support election officials in some states. Trump's rhetoric, though, was setting the stage for him to claim voter fraud if he lost the election. But would he ask the military to get involved somehow? The media was reporting that many people were worried about such a thing, with theories circulating that the president might order the military to collect ballot boxes or oversee state recounts. I thought calling out the military to deal with civil unrest, if violence broke out over the election results, was far more plausible. Again, I had no indication that anything like the former was being considered, but I knew the president and those closest to him well enough by now to expect anything. We needed to be ready just in case. On the afternoon of October 22nd, I had a conference call that invited all 50 state adjutant generals, TAGs, the individuals in charge of the National Guard in their respective states, as well as the four TAGs from D.C. and the territories, to discuss the upcoming election. I thanked them for all the great work their soldiers and airmen had done so far this year. It was probably the most challenging period for the Guard in over four decades, but an epic one that highlighted the professionalism, commitment, and breadth of skills that the Guard brought to the states and nation. I acknowledged up front with the TAGs that some Guard personnel routinely supported elections and some did not. And for those that did, their role was often unique to the state and their electoral practices. I also recognized that they were operating under the authorities of the governors and not under my legal authority. If I didn't like something they were doing or that a governor asked them to do, I more likely than not couldn't order them to stop. Rather, I'd have to call the governor and raise the issue with him or her directly. That said, my request of the TAGs was to keep us in the Pentagon informed about their activities and let us know immediately if they were or expected to be directed to do something out of the normal. I expressed my concerns about the optics of service members in uniform on election day and how our fellow citizens, the media, or elected leaders could misinterpret our role. At the end of the day, most people don't understand, and probably don't care, about the distinctions between active, guard, and reserve units. In their minds, the uniform makes them all the same, even though they are quite different. I also asked everyone to keep elected officials, community leaders, and the media well informed too, so as to prevent any misunderstandings about the role and mission of Guard personnel in the days leading up to and following November 3rd. I implored them to start doing this now, and was pleasantly surprised to learn that many had already begun that process in their states. With that, a couple of TAGs briefed me on the role Guard cyber units were playing in their states to safeguard the integrity of the election. A few others updated me on the logistical support roles they were performing. 16 states were asking their Guard units to provide some sort of assistance on election day, with another 4 states involved in cybersecurity. I took several questions before we wrapped up and then thanked them once again for their efforts. By the end of October, the anxiety level about Election Day was sky high, and conspiracy theories involving the military seemed to be everywhere. Some stories out there spoke of possible moves by the White House to seize ballot boxes in contested states and employ the military to hold a new election if Trump was losing, to suspend the Constitution and declare a limited martial law. More credible was the possibility that hardcore activists on the losing side, right or left, would fill the streets and become violent. These were crazy days, so I didn't want to take anything for granted. I had watched as the president became more aggressive, egged on by some in the White House as the election neared and the polls remained unchanged with Biden at a high single-digit lead. I also knew that he often turned to the military when times got tough. So I needed to think through all contingencies and make sure I had circuit breakers in place in the event things started spinning out of control, as they had in early June. At my direction, Mark Milley had put word out long ago to the combatant commanders to give us a heads up at once if they ever received a phone call from anyone in the White House, especially if any unusual requests came with it. This system had worked well in the past for more routine matters, so I knew the commanders would be diligent. With the election looming, however, I was more focused now on the National Guard. I asked Generals Hokanson and Milley to meet with me privately on the afternoon of October 30th, the last Friday before the election. The ostensible purpose of the meeting for scheduling, since many people in the Pentagon had access to my calendar, was to get an update on the Guard MP companies we still had on alert in Alabama and Arizona, as well as any final modifications to the Adjutant General's support to their states over the coming days. The three of us sat in the large conference room across the hall from my office. Hokanson was seated to my left and Milley to my right at the end of the long table. My chief of staff and one other person from my team joined us, sitting in chairs along the broad back wall.
The relative emptiness of the room made it seem quiet and lonely. This was a serious moment. With the updates on the Guard MP companies completed, I turned to Hokanson and took a deep breath as I thought through the right words to say next. I looked him straight in the eye and said, "General Hokanson?" with the formality that our respective positions called for, followed by, "Dan," which our 38 years of friendship made more appropriate, and started talking in a very matter-of-fact manner, underlining the seriousness with which I took this next matter. I told him that if at any point in the coming days, before, during, or after the election, you get a call from anyone at the White House, take it, acknowledge the message, and call me immediately, I said. The same rule applies if you hear of any tags or governors getting a similar call. I then asked him to figure out a discreet way to get this last part out, which he said he would. Without being too explicit, my message was clear. The U.S. military was not going to get involved in the election, no matter who directed it. I would intercede. Hokanson understood. We had known each other since our plebe year at West Point. Duty, honor, country, and obeying our oath to the Constitution were drilled into him just like me. I could count on him. The fact was I needed mechanisms in place, circuit breakers, should the White House try to circumvent me to do something inappropriate. There seemed to be too much of this happening as of late, and I wanted to be ready for anything. I was the sole civilian in the chain of command between the president and the uniformed military, after all, and had a critical role to perform. Moreover, the whole point of my game plan, the reason that I had taken so much crap over the last several months, was to be in this position at this moment, to act. The essence of American democracy was free and fair elections, followed by the peaceful transition of power. If we didn't have that, then what type of democracy did we have? It was my goal to protect this precious gift our founders gave us. That's what our oath to the Constitution was all about. I had several cards to play if we arrived at that point, but first and foremost, I knew this was a decision for civilian leadership. Me, the Senate-confirmed Secretary of Defense, to make and act upon, not the general officers. General Milley privately told me that he and the Joint Chiefs discussed such a scenario, and all had agreed to resign if pressed to break their oath. I told him that I couldn't allow that situation to happen. I couldn't allow them to be put in such a compromising position, especially if the presidential order was legal, but grossly wrong or inappropriate. This would be a real dilemma, and it would be bad for the Republic, the institution, and civilian control of the military if they had to decide one way or the other. If such an order came from the White House, my immediate recourse would be to demand a meeting with the president. I would want to hear and understand the directive straight from him, to offer alternative solutions if such were possible, and to voice my opposition face to face if he was unyielding. If I was unsuccessful, I would be forced to resign on the spot in protest. But that wouldn't be the end of the line for me. My next moves would have been a combination of actions, such as phone calls to senior Republicans on Capitol Hill requesting their intercession with the president, followed by a press conference where I informed the country about all that had transpired and continued to unfold. I would present my best case and make an appeal to the American people, their elected leaders in Congress, and the institutions of government to intervene. The point would be to buy time and put pressure on the president to stand down. November 3rd came and went without any incident involving the armed forces. Thank God. I'd like to believe that any temptation to misuse the military in some fashion was tempered by the president's and his staff's certain knowledge that I wouldn't do his bidding. In the weeks and months leading up to the election, close friends and colleagues would ask me my thoughts on the contest. I would simply say that I wanted the election to be clean and clear, meaning no corruption that could overturn the results, and an electoral vote margin large enough to prevent any serious challenge to the outcome. If we had a repeat of what happened in Florida in 2000, with only a few hundred votes deciding the winner of the contest, that could be an invitation for mischief. I was relieved then to wake up on the morning of November 4th to learn that the election was not, in fact, balanced on a razor-thin margin. Joe Biden was ahead with large enough vote counts in enough states, coupled with strong indications that other open races were trending his way, that it would be difficult for Trump to seriously challenge the results. The American people had spoken, and the outcome was obvious and becoming more certain with each passing day. That said, I was not surprised by the allegations of fraud and malfeasance that some GOP officials would begin levying. Trump and his campaign did the same and began exploring ways to challenge some of the vote counts. That was part of the process, and it is important to the integrity of any election that credible allegations be investigated. It would delay the outcome, I thought, but not too long, and would most likely not change it. I never imagined, however, that these challenges would go on, and play out through November, December, and January. It was a national embarrassment that undermined our democracy, our credibility, and our leadership on the world stage. Chapter 22. October Surprises. As October arrived, our political antennae at the Pentagon had to be recalibrated again. We were a little over 4 weeks away until the election, and Trump still trailed Biden in the polls, though things appeared to be tightening some. Around this time of year, the media and political pundits began the quadrennial speculation about October surprises that could dramatically take the election in one direction or another. This was on our minds as well, ever cognizant that use of the military can be a way for a president to wrap himself in the flag and take an action abroad that would have a decent chance of rallying the country around him for a short period. While the White House can take actions such as these to boost a president's ratings, his opponents can launch their own surprises that can tarnish him. Some thought the report by the New York Times on September 27, 2020, claiming Trump paid only $750 in federal income taxes in 2016 and 2017, and that in 10 of the previous 15 years, he allegedly paid no income taxes at all, was the first effort at damaging the president. I was more concerned that someone in the White House would look to do the opposite, boost Trump's ratings by tasking the U.S. military to do something extraordinary, something that would cross one or more of my four no's. I wanted no part in political maneuverings like this. These concerns weren't without merit. I had been down this path a few times before. The most recent had occurred a month or so before, as I briefly referenced in an earlier chapter, and it involved Iran. Iran continued to be a top priority for the administration, but took a back seat as the Afghanistan peace deal became the focus of attention in February 2020, followed by COVID from March onward. At the Pentagon, and certainly in CENTCOM, that was definitely not the case. Tensions remained high with Tehran, the Iraqi government was still in turmoil, the fate of the U.S. presence in the country was uncertain, and the militia groups were more unpredictable than ever. Tehran was trying to keep them under control, though, a good sign that we had restored deterrence, but every now and then one of the groups felt the need to shoot a few rockets at Americans. This was the state of play by the summer of 2020. On July 7th, the National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien organized a meeting, chaired by Vice President Pence, to discuss options the various departments should consider taking against Iran to address their uranium enrichment efforts. It was a full meeting with Mark Meadows, State, CIA, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, Defense, Treasury, and Commerce attending. O'Brien kicked off the discussion with a visible sense of urgency, his voice pitched and speech rapid. His description of the situation was quite alarmist. His personal assessment seemed far different from what the intelligence community, IC, was reporting. The specific concern was about an Iranian breakout, which means the time required for Tehran to produce enough weapons-grade uranium for one nuclear weapon. Then, of course, separate from this process is the additional time it takes to design and assemble an actual nuclear device. The IC was confident in their ability to determine these things. O'Brien wasn't. He seemed to think the Iranians were much closer to doing both. Each of the departments walked through their ongoing and planned actions with a good discussion on the topic of sanctions. The Treasury, the CIA, and the DOD also reported in. O'Brien was pushing for text redacted and military action, with Pence subtly leaning in behind him, also seeming to support some type of action.
I pushed back, asking, "What's the rush? Why act in the next 90 days if the CIA has confidence in their timelines?" O'Brien squirmed in his chair a little, leaned in slightly, and quickly responded with, "The president has an appetite to do something." Aha. Mark Meadows quickly jumped in to contradict this statement, which was both smart and curious. "What is going on at the White House?" I asked myself. "Why do these two have such different views about what Trump wants? Why are we even having this meeting in the first place?" We went around and around a few more times discussing other things with various takeaways from the meeting and some follow-ups here and there, but there was no directive for kinetic action by the DOD. About 6 weeks later, on August 20th, I was in Colorado Springs hosting the changes of command for Northern Command and Space Command. This was the same event when Mark Meadows called me about civil unrest in Portland. General Milley showed up about 30 minutes prior to the event, having recently arrived from D.C., and asked to speak with me privately. We went to a small room that was cluttered with a couple of desks and other workplace items. As he stood there in his dress uniform, speaking in hushed tones, General Milley updated me on a few things. The most alarming matter was a call he received from Robert O'Brien the evening before. O'Brien told him that the president wanted to strike a senior Iranian military officer who was operating outside of Iran. Milley and I were aware of this person and the trouble he had been stirring in the region for a long time. But why now? What was new? Was there an imminent threat? What about gathering the national security team to discuss this? Milley said he was stunned by the call, and he sensed that O'Brien put the president up to this, trying to create news that would help Trump's re-election. The chairman had maneuvered to quickly end the call by telling the National Security Advisor, "We'll need to look at the intelligence and discuss the matter with CENTCOM, and then I'll talk with Secretary Esper." I couldn't believe it. I had seen this movie before, where White House aides meet with the president, stir him up, and then serve up one of their great ideas. But this was a really bad idea with very big consequences. How come folks in the White House didn't see this? I told the chairman that, for the record, we were not going to do anything with this message until I received a written order from the president. If O'Brien called back, he was to tell him that. I would do the same if O'Brien raised it with me. There was no way I was going to unilaterally take such an action, particularly one fraught with a range of legal, diplomatic, political, and military implications, not to mention that it could plunge us into war with Iran, without the opportunity to tease these issues out, discuss them with my fellow cabinet members, and so on. I needed to learn the facts, hear the intelligence assessment, understand the issue we were trying to resolve, and then measure it all against my 9 considerations. And then, I would want to meet with the president to offer my views and recommendations and to give him options. That was my duty. While as surprising as this might be for most, it was not for me. Months earlier, on February 19th, I had visited Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota to meet airmen and officers responsible for manning 2 legs of our nuclear triad. The next day, I traveled to Omaha, Nebraska to meet with the leadership team of U.S. Strategic Command. On the flight home that evening, I received word that O'Brien wanted the DOD to strike a couple of targets in western Syria. Apparently, the NSC received some type of information that a terrorist was in or near a refugee camp. O'Brien was requesting that we get the location from his staff and quickly organize a strike to take out the bad guys. Nobody could verify the information, though. Even if we could, there were several issues we had to take into consideration, such as legality, diplomatic impact, collateral damage, and the effect on other missions, not to mention disrupting the uneasy standoff between Russian, Syrian, and Turkish forces in the area. For some on the NSC staff, it seemed that these questions were details that really didn't need to be considered, and that the interagency didn't need to be aware of, let alone discuss, as if the Defense Department should just send up aircraft and start shooting missiles at people. This was ludicrous, and it was one of the main reasons I was so concerned, going back much earlier, that if I resigned my position, who would the president install behind me? And then what would they do? Would they act on these crazy ideas? I spoke with Milley about this, and later called Gina Haspel and Mike Pompeo. Pompeo wasn't aware of the action, but Haspel was.
She was as taken aback as I was, and was drafting a formal letter of objection for the record to send O'Brien. I should have probably done the same, but a verbal conveyance seemed sufficient at the time. I would later start putting more of my objections and concerns in written form, however. To close out this matter at the time, I told my folks to ignore the directive. If someone in the NSC wanted this to happen, I would need an order from the president and the opportunity to discuss it with him. O'Brien's call in late August regarding a strike on the Iranian officer was the last time something involving Iran seriously came up before the election. Milley and I kept a careful watch on it, though, concerned about breaching our four no's, and were equally pleased to see that Tehran was acting with relative restraint. We needed this uneasy situation to hold. But now it was October, and on Friday the 2nd, the president revealed that he and the First Lady had tested positive for COVID-19. I learned of this news while in Morocco, on day 4 of a previously planned trip to North Africa that we had postponed several months due to the pandemic. My travels had me leaving the capital, Rabat, the next day for Kuwait, with a quick stop in Qatar first. The purpose behind my unplanned visit to Kuwait City was to pay my respects on the president's behalf and to express the condolences of the United States on the recent passing of Sheikh Sabah al-Ahmad al-Sabah, the Emir of Kuwait. The Kuwaitis had always been good friends of the United States, hosted thousands of American service members in their small, oil-rich country, and were a moderating voice in the region. It was important to visit them during such a difficult time. I had remained in touch over the weekend with the Vice President, and on Sunday, October 4th, we had a planned call with the President. He wanted to get an update from his national security team, so Pence, Pompeo, O'Brien, Milley, and I, from the plane on my way back to Washington, joined on a secure call with Trump and Meadows, both of whom were at Walter Reed. It took a few minutes to get the president on the line, so the rest of us chatted while we waited. I was unsure of what we would hear when he finally did sign on. Based on what the news shows were saying, I was expecting a weak, faint voice to greet us, maybe struggling ever so slightly to catch a breath, asking questions but not really engaged, though enough to make this a check-the-box moment that the White House press team could trumpet to the world. But then Trump jumped on the line, opening with a strong, "Hello, everyone," and sharing that he was feeling great and that Melania and I are doing well, never felt better. He sounded surprisingly good and very engaged, much like any other day, a far different profile than what many in the press were conveying. Indeed, one of the reporters traveling with me had tweeted a day or so before that Trump was incapacitated. In my view, this was a reckless statement, and we had no idea how she was able to make such an assessment thousands of miles away in Morocco. Trump seemed hardly out of action. He was clearly anxious to work and discuss issues. We started going down the line, each taking turns giving the president a 1 to 2 minute update. I spoke about our military readiness around the world, reassuring everyone of our posture, and then took quick dives into the current state of play with China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran. The president was in good spirits, bouncing around from topic to topic as he normally did. He then focused in on 3 discrete matters. It was clear they were on his mind. Maybe his stay at Walter Reed gave him time to reflect. They were questions he asked numerous times. Should we get out of Iraq now? When are we getting out of Africa? And what about our withdrawal from Afghanistan? We each took turns speaking. On Iraq, I told the president we had already reduced our footprint in the country by a couple thousand to around 3,000 and were in a much better position from a force protection standpoint than we were a year ago. It was important to stay in Iraq to help them, and us, ensure ISIS's defeat, but also to counter Iran's malign influence in the country and the region, which was the more strategic and longer-term concern. I said that if we leave Iraq now, it will look like the militia groups are chasing us out, and it will send the wrong message to friends and foes alike in the region. The president didn't push back, and frankly surprised me by saying, "I agree, let's not rush." On Africa, we all knew where he stood on this issue. He wanted all U.S. military personnel off the continent, all diplomats removed, and all embassies closed. He didn't see the value in any Defense or State Department presence.
Pompeo and I had argued against doing all this since my earliest days as Secretary of Defense, and like I had done in the past, I pivoted to the fact that I was conducting reviews with all my combatant commanders to see where we could free up time, money, and manpower to put back into our highest priorities. Africa Command was the first in the chute, so I was able to update the President on the many adjustments and reductions we had already made, including in Somalia, without jeopardizing our ability to deal with threats to the homeland. Millie joined in with an update on our enhanced efforts to find and rescue an American, Jeff Woodkey, whom terrorists were holding hostage in West Africa. The President didn't comment too much on any of this, which would be curious in retrospect given what was ongoing below him and would happen later. Finally, on Afghanistan, Millie and I briefed that we are on track to be down to 4,500 U.S. military personnel in country by the end of November, as we'd agreed in the summer. Pompeo had covered the diplomatic efforts, and I reinforced his message that, while progress was slow, we were still moving forward. After all, peace talks had begun in Qatar, something that seemed unimaginable a year ago, and no Americans had been killed in nearly 9 months. It was nice not going to Dover Air Force Base to welcome our deceased service members back home and trying to console their grieving family members. Regarding the timeline for Afghanistan, I added, as I usually did, that 4,500 remains a good place to pause and assess the situation before making further adjustments. Our commanders were good with this number from a security and mission standpoint, but we need to determine in November if the conditions warrant any other reductions. The call ended well, with the President largely, superficially, in agreement with what we reported, but not really. I still knew he wanted out of all these places. I was just surprised he didn't press us further to get immediately out. Trump thanked us for our efforts and expressed his desire to get back on the campaign trail. We all returned the thanks and wished him well. For some reason, though, O'Brien, the National Security Advisor, jumped back in as the call was wrapping up to say, "Mr. President, we all love you very much. Get well. We love you. We love you." I couldn't believe it. As I put down the phone, I reflected upon what we just discussed. We still had a few weeks to go before the election, and while ideas about attacking Iran or Venezuela had faded some, we weren't out of the woods yet. The President's focus on Iraq, Afghanistan, and Africa wasn't unusual, but given the timing, context, and interest, I took note. Would he try to do something extraordinary in one of these places to fire up the base, deliver on a campaign commitment, or get the country focused on things other than his tax records or COVID? Who knew? We just needed to be alert and attuned to the period we were now entering, a lesson learned from early June. Incumbent administrations from both parties have done unusual things in the past when it comes to the final weeks of a contested presidential election. After all, that's how we ended up with the phrase October surprise. In mid-September, O'Brien had informed me that Trump wanted out of Somalia. There was no explanation why, only that he wanted out. I told O'Brien that we had already made significant reductions to our forces in East Africa after having narrowed our forces down to what we needed to train the Somalis, monitor al-Shabaab's activities, and have the strike capability to ensure these Islamic insurgents didn't threaten the U.S. homeland. I had explained this to both O'Brien and Trump in the past a few times, but it never seemed to resonate. The President viewed these nations, as he once infamously said, as shithole countries, and he didn't see much value in having any Americans, whether they be military personnel or diplomats, based anywhere on the continent. The bottom line was that Trump wanted out of Africa, completely, and Somalia now seemed to be the start point, according to O'Brien. The U.S. military presence in Africa wasn't big to begin with fewer than 7,000 troops on the continent when I became Secretary of Defense. About half of that number were in Djibouti, a country of only 9,000 square miles on the Horn of Africa that borders Somalia and is composed of fewer than 1 million people. It was a geostrategic point with an ample port at the southern end of the Red Sea. The Arabian Peninsula, Yemen specifically, sat directly opposite its coastline. U.S. military personnel stationed in Djibouti provided a range of logistical, operational, and command and control support for both AFRICOM and CENTCOM.
The balance of U.S. forces in Africa were spread across the continent, with fewer than 200 personnel in North Africa, 1,400 or so mostly in Somalia and Kenya to deal with al-Shabaab, and the remainder in West Africa searching for American hostages held captive in the region and supporting French operations to defeat Islamic extremists in Chad, Niger, Mauritania, and Burkina Faso. The biggest terrorist threat in Africa is al-Shabaab, an Islamic jihadist group based in the East. The group formed in 2006 in Somalia and forged ties with al-Qaeda a few years later, with the aim of controlling this troubled, desperate land and then spreading its hardcore beliefs on the continent. The United States and other countries had already designated al-Shabaab a terrorist organization, and with several thousand fighters in its ranks, it controlled large swaths of rural Somalia, occasionally conducting high-profile attacks in urban areas, principally in the capital of Mogadishu. If I was going to free up time, money, and manpower to implement the National Defense Strategy and shift our focus to China and Russia, then Africa was a good place to start. It was an economy of force theater in the Pentagon strategy to begin with, meaning it was a command where we were willing to accept risk by providing them the minimum essential resources, for example, people, forces, budget, to accomplish their mission. This last point, their mission, was important, particularly when you need to get into the nitty-gritty work of reforming a large bureaucracy such as the DOD. Like every other command, AFRICOM was operating on hundreds of directives that were many years old that had accumulated over time, like barnacles on a ship's hull. Sometimes these were out of date or in conflict with other instructions. All needed review. These orders were driving AFRICOM's requirements for troops, equipment, and other resources, however. Therefore, as we began the process of reviewing them and culling the list, one of the biggest decisions I made was to draw the line about when and how to engage terrorist groups around the world, not solely in Africa. In short, if a group had the means and intent to strike the U.S. homeland, then we kept the pressure on. If it had the intent but not the means, then we monitored it and occasionally took out key leaders and critical targets. If it didn't have the intent, let alone the means, then it was time to end the mission. All agreed that West Africa required monitoring only by the IC. We could make significant reductions in our force presence there. While I was also willing to continue providing air transport, aerial refueling, and overhead surveillance support to the French military for a little while longer, I wanted them to pay full freight for this support, which came to about $50 to $70 million annually. We had a great relationship with the French military on the ground, but it was important to begin weaning them off this temporary assistance. We had been providing it for many years without complaint, while their political leaders in France were sticking it to the United States in other areas. Moreover, my strategic assessment of the situation in West Africa was that the French weren't winning. After so many years, despite their creditable efforts, they had achieved a stalemate at best. Mission fatigue in Paris was settling in. In my view, they were setting the stage to leave and were messaging as much. Why wait? I thought. Indeed, in the summer of 2021, Paris would announce that it was curtailing its mission in West Africa and withdrawing most of its troops. Views about the threat of al-Shabaab in East Africa were a little mixed, however. My assessment was that al-Shabaab had some interest in attacking the United States, but they didn't have the means. They should be monitored with the ability to strike key leaders and critical targets when needed in the event they evolved over time. But maintaining forces in the region on a steady-state basis at current levels didn't make sense. I heard this often as I spoke with operational leaders who spent time there. Most folks agreed with me. AFRICOM disagreed, of course. Such an assessment would affect their resources. This was one of the challenges with managing the combatant commands in the broader context of the Defense Department. Most complained about being under-resourced. Some couldn't accept their priority in the bigger scheme of things, and a few would stretch the risk assessment to justify their demands. Nonetheless, I made the decision, based on an option developed by the commander, General Steve Townsend, to consolidate our forces in southern Somalia and focus on al-Shabaab's external operating capabilities, those most likely to be plotting against the U.S. homeland. This would bring the force in Somalia down below 1,000, yet allow them to keep training the country's armed forces so they could pick up this mission full-time one day. This seemed like a prudent and responsible step for now. After Somalia's elections in early 2021, I wanted to look at going down to 200 to 300 personnel in-country, but do so in coordination with our partners on the ground. I spoke with Mike Pompeo about Somalia during our weekly call on September 21st. He wasn't tracking the president's supposed direction either, which surprised me. The DOD didn't operate in a vacuum. State had the lead for U.S. foreign policy, of course, so our presence and activities needed to align with and support them,